Hi, welcome back to Joe Blogs. In today's episode, I want to talk to you about the ongoing problems in Cuba.
Cuba saw its largest departure of people last year.
It is historic and record-breaking.
In terms of absolute numbers, this is the largest total number of Cubans that have migrated to the United States in a single year period since 1959.
The dire economic crisis in Cuba is mainly to blame for the mass exodus. The pandemic and U.S. sanctions have worsened the already inefficient centralized economy. Blackouts, food, and medicine shortages are part of daily life on the island.
By last October, the average Cuban household was going 10 hours a day without electricity.
Cuba's electric grid is old, tired, is inefficient, is obsolete.
The Soviets, before the Soviet Union fell apart, had built a number of electrical plants. Those plants, they are in no working conditions.
The Soviet-designed nuclear plant in the province of Cienfuegos never completed.
The island needs to update its rickety infrastructure, but it doesn't have the money. The Communist Party wants to avoid a repeat of the summer 2021 protests when tens of thousands hit the streets across the island. Those protests started after a 12-hour power cut in a small westerly town.
Since the breakup of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s, Cuba has been experiencing economic difficulties. However, over the course of the last 10 years, those difficulties have got much more severe. And in today's video, I want to provide you with the latest update as to what's happening in Cuba, because there's not a lot of coverage in mainstream media. So in today's video, I'll give you a very quick recap on how Cuba got itself into the situation it's in today. Because before it decided to go down the communist road, Cuba's biggest trading partner was the USA, which geographically is very close to the country. However, over the course of the last 60 years or so, obviously things have taken a completely different turn. So we'll have a look at what's going on with regards to the power crisis, because as a direct result of the strong relationship that was built up with Russia during the Cold War era, most of the power stations in Cuba are oil-fired, and obviously that's bad news when the price of oil spikes, like it did following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So we'll have a look at what's happening with the power crisis and the ongoing blackouts that are being experienced in the country. We'll then have a look at how Turkey is actually helping out with regards to that power crisis, and that sounds quite bizarre because Turkey's obviously located a very long way away from Cuba. But Turkey have come up with a really innovative idea with regards to floating power stations. We'll have a look at the dramatic increase in emigration that's taken place in Cuba over the course of the last year or so, and how some of the policy changes that have been introduced in the USA over the course of the last 6 or 7 years have driven that increase in emigration. We'll talk about the recent strengthening of relations between Russia and Cuba. Obviously, with what's going on in Ukraine, Russia is now looking for more trading partners. It's looking for more friendly nations. And so it's started to get closer to Cuba again. We'll also talk about what Venezuela is doing with regards to the Cuban crisis. We'll also have a look at Cuba's movements towards receiving overseas investment. We'll have a look at what the situation is with regards to Cuba's debt. And then finally today, I'll wrap up with my summary as to what I think is likely to happen in Cuba over the course of the next 3 to 6 months. Cuba is the largest of all of the Caribbean islands and has a population of around 11 million people. Cuba is located around 100 miles from the south tip of Florida and is so close that the old joke goes, what's the capital of Cuba? Miami. Up until the late 1950s, the USA and Cuba actually had a very strong trading relationship. However, in 1959, Fidel Castro took over as the ruler of the country and introduced common ownership policies and took over ownership of a lot of assets that were owned by the American government and also closely aligned itself with Russia and the Soviet Union. As a result of this, the USA placed an embargo on Cuba, and heavy sanctions have been in place against Cuba since 1962. Now, throughout the 60s, 70s, and early 80s, the relationship between Russia and Cuba was very strong, and Russia actually provided a lot of financial support and sent large quantities of oil to Cuba, and Cuba built up its power station network using that oil. In the late 80s, as the Soviet Union started to fall apart, the support to Cuba fell, and this put major economic pressure on the Cuban authorities, which led to a debt default in 1986. Now, following the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1990, Cuba was thrown into economic crisis and was thrown a lifeline subsequently by Venezuela, which was also operating a communist policy. But unfortunately, Venezuela went into its own economic crisis in 2016, and this led to a major fall in the amount of oil that Venezuela was providing to Cuba. And as a result, Cuba has been in an economic crisis ever since. In the summer of 2022, Cuba was experiencing major power shortages. It didn't have enough cash to buy in enough oil to keep all of the lights on, and so it was forced to introduce planned blackouts. And unfortunately, those planned blackouts have now returned.
Cubans throughout the country's provinces are facing power cuts. Michel Vega says he often has to put up with six-hour blackouts.
Bueno, cuando se va la luz, sencillamente...
When the lights go out, you can't sleep until it comes back. I have an 8-year-old child who has to go to school the next day, so I have to be by his side, keeping the mosquitoes at bay so he can sleep.
It's an issue for the workforce too. In the all-important agriculture sector, production relies on power.
We can't crush sugarcane because we need electricity. And so if there's no electricity, we can't mill. The cane rots, you can't work, you can't earn money.
The Cuban Minister of Energy and Mines has announced that rolling blackouts will resume in Cuba and will last until May 2023, while the country overhauls its decade-old oil-fired power stations ahead of the energy-intensive summer season. The blackouts are forecast to last around 3 hours each, and repair and maintenance work on the plants will continue throughout the year to continue incorporating power and increasing the reserve to reach June, July and August in better conditions than the previous year. The energy minister went on to say that unexpected problems with power generation could flare up again in the coming months, causing more severe blackouts, but nothing like the 10-hour average of October 2022. Cuban officials have blamed fuel shortages, deferred maintenance, and difficulties processing heavy sour Cuban crude, also burned at its plants, for hobbling power generation.
Cuba solving a big problem with help from a Turkish company. What you're looking at is a power barge, one of four in Cuba, now providing a portion of Cuba's electrical power.
You pull up to a country, you dock it near a country, and you basically plug it in.
There are now four Turkish-owned power ships serving Cuba. It's estimated that they provide between 10 and 15% of the island's electrical needs. The Turkish company Karpowership has ships placed worldwide, heavy players in providing power to third world nations.
Turkey has, you know, an increasing commercial, economic, and political relationship with Cuba. The president of Turkey, Erdogan, has a an increasing footprint in Cuba.
The Turks heavily involved in the Cuba pharmaceutical sector. A Turkish company manages the port of Havana. The power ships, a highly visible symbol of influence and critical to Cuba's tourism cash cow.
You can't very well expect to fill up a hotel and then tell people that they have no air conditioning or the power's going to be off in their rooms for 4 or 5 hours a day.
Dire economic conditions in Cuba are largely to blame for the population's mass departure. More than 220,000 Cubans arrived at the border between the US and Mexico over the past year. That's nearly six times as many in the previous year. Many have fled because of shortages in food, medicine and power after former President Donald Trump tightened sanctions on Cuba in 2019. A trade embargo brought in by President John F. Kennedy has also been in place for 60 years. The pandemic had a devastating impact on Cuba's tourism industry. It was a vital source of revenue that came to a standstill. And in July 2021, the biggest protest since Cuba's revolution in the late 1950s broke out over the government's handling of the economic crisis and the pandemic. The widespread crackdown that followed added to those wanting to leave.
One of the reasons for the increase in Cuban emigration over the course of the last few years have been the changes in US policy. Between 2017 and 2021, the Trump administration pursued a maximum pressure strategy against Cuba, introducing 243 new sanctions, actions, and coercive measures. Among those contributing to the emigration from Cuba were the withdrawal of US consular services in Cuba in 2017, which ripped up previous migration accords under which the United States committed to issue 20,000 visas annually to Cubans for travel to the USA, and suspended the Cuban Family Reunification Parole Program, which had the result of wrenching families apart. Cubans now applying for visas were instructed to travel overseas to do so with no guarantee of success. The new legislation also eliminated legal channels for Cubans in the USA to send remittances to their families back home. And as a result of these changes, cash remittances to Cuba are estimated to have fallen by nearly $1.8 billion between 2019 and 2021. And finally, the third biggest change was returning Cuba to the US list of state sponsors of terrorism, obligating international banks and finance institutions to categorize Cuba as high risk, which therefore affected all payments for goods, services, remittances, or donations. When President Biden took office, he left all of these policies in place. And on the 9th of January 2023, the Biden administration announced that a pandemic-related immigration policy introduced under Donald Trump, Title 42, would be extended to send illegal immigrants from Cuba, Nicaragua, and Haiti caught crossing the US-Mexico border back to Mexico. Title 42 was initially introduced in March 2020, allowing border police to rapidly expel migrants, even those seeking asylum, on the pretext of slowing the spread of COVID-19 through detention centres. If Cubans caught at the US-Mexico border or in the United States without documents are expelled to Mexico, they will not be eligible for residence under the Cuban Adjustment Act. Now, all of this has obviously come at a very bad time in terms of the population of Cuba. Because of the economic crisis, there is a major economic push factor to move somewhere where they can earn more money, and the USA is the obvious attraction. And it was reported that in 2022, over 313,000 Cubans arrived in the USA, most of them without visas and entering from Mexico. And this number of people is more than double the previous peak of Cuban migration in 1980. Over the course of the last 6 months or so, the ties with Russia have started to strengthen again. Russia recently announced an emergency donation of 25,000 tons of wheat to combat shortages on the island, a further sign of deepening ties between the two long-term allies. Cuba's Deputy Minister of Foreign Trade said that the Russians had provided Cuba with food and medicine recently as part of an enduring relationship between the two countries. "The Russian government and the people have been on our side in difficult times since the pandemic," she said in a brief interview. Russian President Vladimir Putin and his Cuban counterpart, Miguel Díaz-Canel, unveiled a monument in Moscow in November to revolutionary Cuban leader Fidel Castro, pledging to deepen their friendship in the face of US sanctions against both countries. Cuban state media said in December that the grain deliveries were part of an $11 million package earmarked by Russia to purchase and deliver wheat to Cuba. It was recently reported that Venezuela's state-run oil company, PDVSA, loaded the Panama-flagged supertanker Nolan with 400,000 barrels of fuel oil and will also load 1.13 million barrels of Venezuelan heavy oil, bringing the total cargo to 1.53 million barrels to be sent to Cuba to help with the power crisis. Supertanker Nolan, which is owned by Nigeria-based Tomoros Global Ventures, was blacklisted in November by the US Treasury Department under accusations of being part of an international oil smuggling network that facilitated oil trades for Iran. The tanker has not sent a signal from its transponder since mid-December. The supertanker is bound for Matanzas, where Cuban state companies have been discharging imports by transferring cargoes to smaller vessels through ship-to-ship operations. In an attempt to avoid its own fuel crisis, Venezuela's oil supplies to Cuba in 2022 fell by around 6% to 53,600 barrels per day, independent data based on tanker movement showed. So as you can see from this report, Venezuela is trying to step up its support for Cuba. However, the problems that it has is that Venezuela is in the middle of its own economic crisis. Now, as I mentioned at the start of the video, the USA placed sanctions against Cuba in 1962. However, these sanctions were not applied by the rest of the world, so Cuba still had trading relations. And in the 1960s, 70s and early 80s, Cuba was able to raise debt in the international markets. However, as I mentioned earlier in the video, by the mid-1980s, Cuba was struggling financially. A lot of the economic support that was being provided by Russia in the previous two decades had dried up, and it simply didn't have enough cash to be able to make the interest or principal repayments on any of its debt. And in 1986, it formally defaulted on all of its international debt obligations. Now, the debt that Cuba had issued in the 60s, 70s and 80s was split into two distinct categories. There was intergovernmental debt, so money that Cuba had borrowed from other countries officially, and then there was commercial debt that Cuba had taken from banks and financial institutions. At the time of its default, the governmental debt that Cuba had taken on was split into three categories. It had around $9 billion worth of debt out to Russia as a result of the strong relationship that they'd had. It had around $750 million worth of debt directly from Japan. And then it had around $11 billion worth of debt from a collection of countries that were calling themselves the Paris Club. In terms of agreeing a final settlement on all of its outstanding debt, Cuba agreed with Russia that it would pay back 10% of the $9 billion that it owed, and in exchange for that, Russia agreed to write off 90%. Cuba then struck a deal with Japan to pay back 20% of the $750 million that it owed, and in exchange for that, Japan agreed to write off 80%. The remainder of the intergovernmental debt was held by a number of different countries that were collectively known as the Paris Club. And the Paris Club is a group of 22 countries that first came together in 1956, when Argentina was on the brink of defaulting on its debt, and a meeting was held in Paris where all of the countries that had outstanding debt to Argentina came together and formed an agreement with regards to the debt settlement process. And since that time, this group of countries have met on a regular basis as and when countries are on the brink of default. Now, the negotiations with the Paris Club actually took an enormous amount of time, and an agreement wasn't actually finally settled until 2015, when the Paris Club agreed to write off $8.6 billion of the $11.1 billion outstanding. Now, the net result of that deal is that Cuba has now reached agreement on 85% of all of the debt that it defaulted on in 1986. However, the other 15% is held by a group of commercial lenders known as the London Club. Now, unlike the Paris Club, the London Club doesn't actually have any permanent members. It's effectively a term that's used for the group of lenders who have outstanding debt to any country that's on the brink of defaulting. And the difference between the London Club and the Paris Club is that the members of the London Club are commercial entities who are lending money for the sake of making profit. When we're talking about intergovernmental debt that's provided to countries like Cuba, it's not just about making money. That money is being given to help develop the country, to bring it on to try to get it to become a first world entity. Whereas the main driver for commercial loans is to make profit from that lending and to get back as much as you can from those loans. And that fundamental difference is one of the reasons why Cuba is now being taken to court, because one of the original holders of that debt has actually sold the debt to what's called a vulture fund. And that vulture fund is now doing everything that it can to force Cuba to pay back all of those loan obligations. So the overall situation with regards to Cuba's debt is that they've managed to agree to write down the vast majority of it. However, they still have this residual debt that was previously provided by the London Club, but is now sitting in the hands of vulture funds. And the result of the legal case is pending, which will decide whether or not the Cuban authorities have to repay all of that debt before they could go to international bodies such as the IMF and the World Bank and seek some form of bailout facilities. And so in the meantime, the only real option available to Cuba is to seek help and assistance from friendly nations such as Russia, Turkey, and China. In an effort to try to solve the economic crisis, Cuba has announced that it's now intending to open up its wholesale and retail trade to overseas investors for the first time since 1959. The Deputy Trade Minister stated on evening TV that foreign investors would be allowed to fully own local wholesalers for the first time or to enter the market through joint ventures. Retail operations will be more restricted, but she opened the door to some public-private ventures in that sector as well. The reforms would allow foreign-owned entities to invest in warehouse and back-end logistic operations, supplying state-run and private businesses, for example, supporting the country's effort to improve efficiency in its notoriously unproductive retail sector. Gonzalez said that Cuba would selectively allow some foreign investors into the retail market, providing the investment contributed to the country's socialist goals and lowered prices. The domestic trade minister added that the state would maintain its dominance in retail, but allow for some public-private ventures. We will prioritise these type of initiatives with foreign investors already in Cuba and allied countries, she said. Both officials said the goal was to get more raw materials and goods into the hands of producers and consumers on the island. However, commentators have questioned whether or not this reform will work. It's a step in the right direction, but far too little and too late, said Cuban economist Omar Evelaini. He went on to state that the measures were riddled with caveats and red tape. Both announcements are full of words such as exception, control, and conditions, as if they did not understand how serious the crisis is. So this announcement's really interesting because for the first time, Cuba is opening itself up to the outside world. However, as we just mentioned, there are a lot of caveats, and it seems that they only want to do deals with other countries who either have a relationship with Cuba already or have the same socialist principles. So that's a really limited market. And basically, what Cuba is saying is that the only suitors that it wants to get into bed with are Venezuela, Russia, and potentially China.
a new politician whose name you probably haven't thought of for years, Ilian Gonzalez. The now 29-year-old was just elected to office in his native Cuba, and he says he wants to use his new position to improve relations between the United States and Cuba. Gonzalez was just sworn into the National Assembly this week, and if you don't know who Ilian Gonzalez is, or you just need a refresher, he was just 6 years old when he was rescued floating on an inner tube off the coast of South Florida on Thanksgiving Day, 1999. His mother and several other Cubans died trying to get to the United States. The situation surrounding Gonzalez sparked a diplomatic crisis, with his Miami relatives trying to keep custody of him, while the Cuban government said he belonged with his father, who was back in Cuba. The U.S. government eventually agreed, and the six-month-long saga came to a head in April of 2000, with armed federal agents raiding his relatives' Miami home to extract Ilian Gonzalez and return him to Cuba. This Pulitzer Prize-winning photo of that raid made newspaper and magazine covers around the world. That's what viral was before social media, kids. And it came to symbolize the strained relationship between the two countries, as well as a new era for the politics of many Cuban Americans.
So what's the summary and conclusion today? Well, I wanted to post this video to give you an update as to what's going on in Cuba. And really, the overall summary of today's video is that the situation remains critical. As we discussed earlier in the video, Cuba is a net importer. And over the course of the last 60 years, it's become reliant on its communist friends. In the Cold War period in the 60s, 70s and 80s, it was supported very strongly by Russia. And the majority of that period represented the heyday for Cuban communism. However, since the breakdown of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s, things have got a lot harder for Cuba. Initially, Venezuela stepped in and was supporting the country, but because Venezuela has gone through its own economic crisis over the course of the last 4 years since it was sanctioned by the USA, they haven't been able to offer the same level of support, and Cuba have been left on their own. And the problem that Cuba has, similar to a lot of other countries that we've covered on the channel, is as a net importer, you're very exposed because you don't have a positive balance of trade. You don't have enough raw materials or things that other people want to buy to be able to pay for all of the things that you need to import. So that represents a major problem for any emerging and developing country. But when you layer on top the sanctions that have been applied against the USA, which geographically is Cuba's closest major economy, that makes it even more difficult for Cuba to find a successful way out of this situation. Now, in terms of the immediate problem that Cuba is facing, the power crisis needs to be sorted out. But the problems that Cuba has is that its infrastructure is very old and it's reliant upon oil. And oil is an expensive way to create electricity. That situation was fine in the 60s and 70s when Russia was providing free oil to the country. But now that Cuba is having to source it from the international markets, they're finding that they simply can't afford to buy it. So they're now fully dependent on countries like Russia, Venezuela, Iran, and China providing that oil for free. But obviously, over the long term, there will be a price to pay. And the relationships that Cuba is building with all of those countries is essentially building up a debt. And it will be very interesting to see what becomes of that debt. As I've discussed before on the channel, China has been helping lots of countries all around the world through its Belt and Road Initiative. And a lot of those countries have struggled to be able to service the debt that China has put in place to fund that initiative. And as a result of that, we're now seeing China taking footholds in a number of different countries. I've mentioned Hambantota Port a number of times, which is a port in Sri Lanka that China helped to construct. Sri Lanka couldn't keep up the repayments, and China now have a 99-year lease over that port. So they essentially own part of Sri Lanka. And that sort of arrangement could be something that we see in Cuba over the course of the next 10 years or so. All these friendly nations who are helping out may decide that they want something in return, and that something could be some land or a port or other form of infrastructure in Cuba that could be beneficial to those countries in the long term. And obviously, from the USA's point of view, the last thing that they would want would be Russia taking up some land in Cuba and potentially setting up some form of military base. We had the Cuban Missile Crisis back at the beginning of the 1960s. That almost led to World War III and nuclear destruction. Thankfully, that crisis was averted at the last moment, but there is a possibility as Russia becomes more detached from the West and therefore has to form stronger relations with all of the countries who don't deal with the West, that there could be another significant strengthening of ties between Russia and Cuba, and that at some point in the future, Russia tries to use Cuba as some form of political leverage. So hopefully you've enjoyed today's episode, you found it useful, informative and thought-provoking. If you've liked what I've said, then please give me a thumbs up. Thank you for watching this video all the way through to the end, and here's something to put a smile on your face.